Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Betty Buckley. We review Zorba at City Center, the Fiasco Theater's Two Gentlemen of Verona, and Red Bull Theater's Tis Pity, She's a Whore. The national tours of Pippin and Motown also travel through Orlando, and Matt gives us an update on that. Please stay tuned. And welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, May 10th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Michael Portantier and Matt Tamanini. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many of the places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hello. Also with us is Matt Tamanini. Matt is Broadway World's chief TV and film critic. He writes across all the Broadway World sites, including Broadway World Orlando, and serves as Broadway World's database manager. He received a BA in journalism and communications from The Ohio State University and worked in sports broadcasting, media relations, and journalism. You can follow Matt on Twitter at BWWMatt. Matt, what does that BWW stand for?
Broadway World.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've heard about them.
You've heard of them before.
I've heard of them before. That's right. So good morning, everybody. Peter is off in London. Feel bad for Peter. He's been sent to London to review shows, I believe, for MTI. I'm not sure if it was for MTI or somebody else, but he's in London watching theater, and he will be back next week. But I want to remind people to email Peter if you want to go to the Theater World Awards. The Theater World Awards are on Monday, June 1st at 7 p.m. at the Lyric Theater. And as Michael pointed out last week, it's a very large theater. So please email Peter and go to the Lyric and see the Theater World Awards. Lots of fun people are going to be there in the ceremony. It's always a lot of fun. Contact information for Peter is at BroadwayRadio.com. You will see it there. With us this morning, joining us from Texas via phone, is Betty Buckley. Oh, what can we say? We have arrived on Broadway Radio because Betty's finally here. We love her, and Broadway fans will remember Betty from 1776, Pippin, Cats, Song and Dance, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, Carrie, Sunset Boulevard, and Triumph of Love, as well as many concerts and appearances and various different things. Betty, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning.
Oh, thank you, James. It's a thrill to talk to you guys.
Oh, we're so excited. So coming up, you are going to be traversing the United States and coming back to New York to do two separate things. One of them is a monologue and song interpretation workshop at T. Schreiber Studios on May 18th to the 22nd, and also at Joe's Pub, where you're going to do seven shows on May 28th to the 31st. So tell us first. I mean, the song interpretation and monologue workshop, is this going to be open to the public to visit with you, or is it for the Schreiber Studio students only? Or tell us about that.
No, it's open to the public, and there's a wide range of participants from high school kids that are preparing for their college auditions, college and conservatory auditions, and then some young professionals, some older professionals, and some people who are just aspire to sing or communicate better. I've got a businessman actually taking the class this time because he wants to hone his communication skills.
Wow.
So one of the things I really focus on is I teach what I have been taught by my great teachers, and these tools that are very powerful and really work in terms of making deep connections with audiences. So the workshop focuses a lot on communication skills, but we also welcome auditors who get all the same work, all the same exercises and tools. I just don't critique their work. But it's fun. It's a five-day workshop. It's an intensive, and we have a good time.
Well, that's wonderful. And I mean, you've been doing this for years and years, doing these these master classes. Have you been able to follow up with some of your students that have done them in the past?
Yeah, some of them, I have a continuity. Several people take the class each time I come to New York and have studied with me for a number of years. I'm doing currently also a workshop in Texas at the Modern Art Museum in Fort Worth, Texas.
Oh,
uh-huh. It's a spring and summer workshop that culminates in two concerts in early July. So that's an extended time period. But my great, my bragging rights are that all the kids that have studied with me over the past many years have gotten into the colleges and universities of their choice. So that's pretty exciting stuff.
Oh, that's definitely the mark of success there. So you've been
I
able
think so.
To. Yeah.
I'm very proud of that information.
Well, Betty, I've got a question for you. When you're talking specifically about those young teenagers looking to get into college, what's the thing that really separates someone of that age that someone with your experience can teach them that can kind of get them from being a good, talented performer to being a really well-seasoned, integrated actor that sings?
Well, that takes time. I mean, that's a large order. I don't know if you become a well-seasoned actor, singer by the time you, before you get to college. You know, I consider that a kind of a lifetime's work.
Mm-hmm.
But
sure.
I think I'm a good teacher for the serious student that's very committed. There's a, you know, a large resurgence of interest in the musical theater and performance. They have these awards every spring for a number of years here in Fort Worth called the Betty Buckley Awards, which I'm very honored to be named, that the awards are named in my honor. And so there's been this real resurgence of interest in the musical theater, which is very exciting in all of the local schools. But there's a real difference in, theater is really super fun, of course, and that's why we were all attracted to it in the first place. But it takes a very serious, committed level of study and practice and a real, I think, a profound caring for humanity to become a real good actor, to become a good actor, storyteller. I think you have to really have a lot of compassion for human beings. And so it's not just about me, 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 look, Mom, singing and dancing. You know, it's not that. And so I think sometimes I get kids that, and their teachers have done a good job inspiring in them that excitement for theater. But then I turn it around for them and say, you know, this really isn't about you. It's not really about the audience's approval of you. It's about how you can serve the audience by sharing your story truly from your heart and soul. And so I try to get them to understand that.
Speaking of Texas, I just last night went to a personal appearance Q&A kind of thing that Carol Burnett did.
Oh, nice.
At the St. George Theater on Staten Island. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of really talented people came out of there. I realize it's a big state, but
it's a big state. We've been having major storms and tornado alerts all in North Texas where I live. Last night, boy, howdy, it was like scary.
Oh.
The clouds, you know, you're out there like in staring up at the clouds like, is that a tornado? Is that a tornado? You know, they say tornado. There are two things, tornado watch and then tornado warning.
Mm.
Tornado watch is watch, it may be coming, you know, and tornado warning is get to cover right away.
Right.
So,
you know, Matt, I live in Tornado Alley.
So.
Right up in North Texas, you're sort of near the Oklahoma Panhandle, so we know that, you know, unfortunately, that area of the United States gets hit with a lot of those violent storms.
Yeah. It's crazy. Last night was just it's finally the really scary end of it hit my area about 6 this morning, and man, it's like thunder and lightning. It's pretty exciting stuff, actually.
So I'm going to ask you a terrible question here.
Okay.
So, is it more scary than the first time you rode the tire?
Oh, well, that tire was scary. It wasn't the tire so much that was scary. It was the cherry picker crane that comes out of the ceiling.
To get you.
This, you know, they rebuilt the roof or the ceiling area of the winter garden for cats, and there was a crane that came out on a diagonal. But there was one man-made action in the show where the stagehand had to lift the trap door, which is about 8 feet by 11 feet, out of the ceiling so the crane could come through it. and the night after we won the Tonys, the performance after we won the Tonys, it was a really exciting night, you know, because we'd won something like 8 Tony Awards or something. And the guy, there was a sub who apparently had been drinking and forgot to pull the trapdoor out. And so as the tire is ascending, you know, it goes up about 40 feet in space, and the cherry picker cocaine comes down and hits on the tire, and then I was meant to take a step onto this platform without any, like, safety belts or anything, which was so crazy. And then the crane pulled me out through the ceiling. So the computer, you know, was going according to plan, but the trapdoor was shut. So the crane was trying to break through the ceiling.
Oh.
And Ken Page and I were, like, riding up on the tire, and we hear this, you know, this really loud, scary, growling sound, and wood is flying, and it's coming down, and the cats are jumping out of the way on the stage. And the audience doesn't know the difference because there's all this smoke and fog, you know, and it's supposed to be all very exciting, and it's literally like doomsday is happening, you know. It was like, so as we slowly go up, I'm telling you, I literally saw in slow motion my whole life pass before my eyes. And the last thing I saw was this newspaper headline saying, Tony Award-winning actors killed. And Kim Page says, Betty, are you going to go up there? Because you don't have to. And I said, no, I'm not. Anyway, it broke through the ceiling, and it came down on this, like, it was swinging back and forth instead of coming down straight on its angle, and then just crashed down on the tire. And so I just held on to Ken. Ken held on to me. And the music kept going. The cats kept singing. And then the crane starts to go back up into the ceiling. And I stayed on the tire and started mimicking the finale choreography like I was reprieved from death. It was really quite a night. So, I mean, when they say be careful what you wish for and what you fear most, I mean, really, you know, try not to fear things and try to just stay without expectation, because the two things that, you know, the thing I had dreamed most was to win the Tony, and then I feared most was to be killed by the tire or the crane. And it was like both things happened within, you know, a night, a day of each other. It was like crazy. That was really a remarkable experience.
You can't teach that in a master class.
No, I was like, oh, my God. No, I'm not going on that crazy crane. No.
Oh, my goodness.
I wanted to ask you about something less dangerous, cast recordings.
Okay.
I guess
less dangerous.
maybe they are in a way. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of pressure because this is it, right? But I wanted to ask you,
because you don't have that much time. You just have to go in and knock it out, and you sure don't get to go back and fix anything. It's really, you know, It's a daunting task to get it right.
Oh, sure. I want to ask you specifically about Promises, Promises, because for whatever reason, that recording didn't come out on CD till years later. And then they finally put it out, which was great. The London cast with Tony Roberts and you. And I really enjoy it. I was wondering if you could talk, have you revisited that recording since they re-released it on CD?
I haven't really listened to it in a number of years. I was made to feel very self-conscious about my vocals for that show. You know, I was a huge Burt Bacharach and Hal David fan because I felt like they scored my life in college, and I loved those guys. And I was a huge Michael Bennett fan, who was our choreographer, and of course Neil Simon and David Merrick was our producer. And you know, it was an amazing experience when I was 22 years old to play Fran Kubelik in London and, you know, get to go be a young leading lady in London and in this wonderful, wonderful show. But, you know, I idolized Burt Bacharach, and he, of course, was in love with Dionne Warwick, and who was this great pop star, as you know, and who sang that material originally, and he wanted everybody to sound like Dionne Warwick, and I don't sound like Dionne Warwick. So I was very self-conscious about the way I sang everything. But I think I did okay. I was, you know, I did the show for a year. In fact, Andrew Lloyd Webber told me when he was 19 years old, he snuck in, like, he was in standing room at the Prince of Wales Theater and saw my performance of that when he was 19, which I think is funny.
Wow.
Ironic.
young Andrew Lloyd Webber. Wow.
Yeah, I was 22. He was 19.
And he had put together a handful of really amazing works even earlier than 19.
Yeah, exactly. He was writing from the very beginning.
Very beginning. So, Dark Blue Eyed Blues, which is your encore performance at Joe's Pub coming up on May 28th to the 31st. You had a sold out engagement last fall, and you're coming back to do some new materials. So tell us about that.
Well, what we did last year was Ghostlight, which was my new album produced by T-Bone Burnett. And it was really fun, and my friends and fans came out. It was great, and we had a wonderful, wonderful time at Joe's Pub. You know, I did for years, I worked at the Public Theater for Joe Papp. I did all kinds of workshops there, and we did the original workshop of The Mystery of Edwin Drood there. And, you know, it was such a incredible place and so important to me when I was a young actress and coming up in New York City. And Joe Papp was a real mentor of mine, and so it was a thrill to go back. In fact, his wife, Gail, came to see me perform at Joe's Pub last fall. I haven't seen her in a really long time, and the wonderful Rosemary Tischler, who's the casting lady there for years and years, head of casting. So it was a real reunion for me, and to get back to my old stomping grounds where so many wonderful creative experiences had happened, you know. And Ghostlight was my beautiful album that T-Bone produced, and that collection of music was great to get to share with people live. So we did well, so they're bringing us back May 28th to 31st for another 7 shows. So we're creating a new show with my collaborator and my arranger, the brilliant pianist Christian Jacob, and my writer Eric Kornfeld, who's a very funny guy who's written several of my last cabaret shows with me. He's a very funny, terrific guy. And I've got 4 great musicians: Christian, Tony Marino, my longtime bass player, Todd Eisler, the drummer, and Oz Noy, who's a brilliant guitar player. So we're working on that material now, and Dark Blue Eyed Blues is a song that I wrote when I was 35 and I was in Cats, and it was kind of this love song idea, you know, love gone wrong. And so I'm singing some songs like that, which I've always kind of resisted because I think torch songs, when I was growing up as a kid wanting to be a lady singer, I never understood why lady singers always had to sing My Man Done Me Wrong songs. It was like, I was this budding young feminist, and I was like, this is crazy. Why does it always have to be like this? And then, of course, I grew up and realized why. And so I'm revisiting some of that material, and I'm singing some songs that I've never sung before, and it should be fun. I think the music's good, and I'm also kind of paying homage to the idea of the chanteuse, the lady singer who sings torch, you know, so that idea.
I sort of think, and maybe this is a generalization, but the whole country western feel in the South and the West embraces that the torch song for the women. Do you bring any of that from your Texas roots?
Hey, you know what? I never made that association. That's interesting. You're right. Well, I guess that's what people sing about. You know, when they suffer, they sing. I don't know. When the heart suffers, that makes you want to sing.
Well, speaking of which, you, I love your rendition of This Nearly Was Mine on the Ghostlight album.
Yes. Oh, thank you.
Really lovely, yeah. You know, it's funny. Well, I mean, every other version I know of that song eventually gets really big at the end. And it was never quite convincing to me because I think of the emotion of the song as, I mean, you could justify getting really big in sound, but I think it works much better the way you did it.
Thank you. More wistful, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
It was also written for a man to sing, and he was a pretty grand guy, you know, in South Pacific, that character. But, I've been very interested in, over the years, in singing some of the songs that were written for men. I even did an album with my friend Christian Jacob called Ah Men, The Boys of Broadway. We did that album before Ghostlight came out. And I just picked some of those songs for years. You know, I try to sing these men's songs, and my my advisors would say, you can't sing that song, it's written for a man. And I'm like, okay, then I'll just put together a whole evening of men's songs, and then I can get away with it. You know, so.
Never tell Betty can't.
Yeah, well, sometimes I listen, but eventually. So, yeah, I did that collection of boys' songs, and I still, you know, that song, This Nearly Was Mine, is just, I think it's their most haunting love song.
Yeah.
Hammerstein.
Well, then, of course, you're right. Yeah. I mean, it was Ezio Pinza singing on stage with practically no amplification. So, of course, he was going to sing it that way. So I don't mean to denigrate that in any way. But if one is recording it, and actually it's done that way in the film, for what it's worth, they realize that, I guess, for the film medium, that would be a better way to just keep it really wistful and soft. And it's just you do a beautiful version of it.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Betty, some of our listeners are big, avid collectors of cast recordings and individual performers' recordings, and I wanted to let everybody know that Ghostlight is also available on vinyl, which is a new trend that we love. And I wanted to ask you, do you have a record player?
I do. Yeah, I've had.
Isn't
a really
it great
nice,
to listen to it?
Yeah, I've had it all these years. I enjoy vinyl, and T-Bone, of course, is a real audiophile. You know, he doesn't even believe in digital. In fact, he records everything to tape.
I was going to ask that. That's great.
Because he wants that ambient sound in it, and then he, you know, transfers it over to digital. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, our box set is very beautiful for Ghostlight. It's this beautiful art box that was designed by Gail Morowitz, and with a 24-page booklet of photographs and liner notes, and then the vinyl record, and then two CDs, the CD of Ghostlight and the CD of the record called Bootleg Board Mixes from the Road, that were songs that I'd just taken off board mixes that my sound man had collected through a number of years of concert work, and T-Bone was listening to those, and he said, this is really good the way it is, you should release this to let people know Ghostlight is coming. So we did that. It was released before and the Boys of Broadway, and then Ghostlight came out after that. But, yeah, I'm very proud of the Ghostlight album. I really love it. I really love my friend T-Bone, and I'm very, very grateful. You know, he recorded the first archival recording of my singing when we were both 19 years old. We grew up in Fort Worth together, Fort Worth, Texas, and he had his own recording studio from the time he was 17, and I was a girl singer around town, and our mothers knew each other. So our mothers actually said, you know, T-Bone, you need to record Betty Lynn. So they did this recording of me. And then Phil Bursch at Playbill was starting his own record company, and he released a record in 2007 called Betty Buckley 1967. And
oh, right.
He said, it's the first album you never had. And we sent a copy to T-Bone, and he was very moved to remember what we'd accomplished as kids, you know. And we'd stayed in touch, of course, all these years socially. You know, we'd get together, and he would always say, you know, we should make a new record. And I was like, yeah, when you can work me in between Elton John and the Rolling Stones. That'll be I never took it very seriously, and then... you know, a couple years ago, he called and said, let's do that record. I've got some time. So we did. I'm really happy with it.
Isn't it ironic how there's seemingly pockets of people who grew up together that are so amazingly leaders in their field? I mean, you look at, you know, we talked before about a young Andrew Lloyd Webber who knew that young Tim Rice, and here we are, Betty Buckley and T-Bone. So I want to remind listeners that you can go to bettybuckley.com and check out that vinyl album, as well as an amazingly beautiful website, Betty, and all sorts of other stuff there in her calendar, and her song interpretation monologue workshops coming up at May 18th to the 22nd, and then the public Joe's Pub theater shows are May 28th to the 31st. Betty, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and talking with us.
Thank you. Also, that that vinyl art box record can autographed copies can be purchased at Broadway Cares Equity by Faith.
Oh, great!
So to benefit the organization. So if people felt like buying it there, that it's there. It's at Barney's. And it's on my available on my website, and you can buy it also at Amazon. But it's probably nice to
support Broadway Cares.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, you have a wonderful rest of the day. We'll speak with you soon.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Never saw the sun shining so bright. Never saw things going so right. Noticing the days hurrying by. When you're in love, my, how they fly on. Blue days, all of them gone. Nothing but blue skies from now on. Nothing but blue skies from now on.
First up, Michael got a chance to see Zorba at City Center. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Zorba. Book by Joseph Stein, music by John Kander, lyrics by Fred Ebb. First opened on Broadway in 1968, ran about a year. And this is one of those shows that is not often revived because it's very special. You need just the right people for it. It's the subject matter is not maybe universally embraceable by so many people as opposed to, you know, so many other musicals. But it is well known for having a really excellent score by Kander and Ebb. And it was revived on Broadway in, I believe, the late 80s with Anthony Quinn, who had starred in the previous non-musical film version of Zorba, and also playing the role of Hortense in that production was Lila Kedrova, who had played the role in the movie, and the production was directed by the director of the movie. So that was quite a noteworthy production, and actually ran a little bit longer than the original. But the original was directed by Hal Prince, and it is quite a special musical because, as I say, the score is extraordinary. It's interesting to see Joseph Stein, who wrote the book for Fiddler on the Roof, working with Kander and Ebb around that time, that same time, rather than Bach and Harnick. And the result is a really, really interesting musical about this youngish fellow who comes to Greece. He's inherited a mine, an abandoned mine, and he wants to try to get it going again. And he turns to this fellow who kind of he meets by chance, this fellow who kind of just comes up to him and buttonholes him in a tavern and introduces himself and talks himself into a job. And this guy is Zorba, played by John Turturro in this current New York City Encores production. And Zorba is supposed to be this real, very basic life force peasant kind of person who we've seen, I'm sure, and read about in many other films and books and many other works of art. But the show also, it's not written in a realistic style. It originally started with a bouzouki circle of Greek musicians. It was sort of them telling the story. And there is a character originally called the woman, I believe, but now called the leader, played by Marin Mazie in this production, who really basically functions as a one-person Greek chorus. And her first lyric is, "Life is what you do while you're waiting to die. This is how the time goes by." And the show is very much about life and death. There are several things that happen in that regard during the action. Interestingly enough, that lyric was changed when for the revival. Suddenly, someone thought it was like too much. So it was changed to life is what you do till the moment you die. People of a certain age may remember the television commercial for that revival because I remember it playing constantly. And Debbie Shapiro Gravitt, I believe at the time she was just named Debbie Shapiro, was the leader in that production. And there, and I have a very strong memory of her singing "Light Your Life Is What You Do." Well, actually, I think she didn't sing that part in the commercial, but she was featured prominently in the commercial because Anthony Quinn, very frankly, could not sing well at all. But anyway, they have gone back to the original for the most part for this Encores production, but they, I have to say, they cut the Buzuki circle at the beginning, which is a really major cut, and Encores is not known for cutting major musical sections. They really cut the first half of the first number pretty much, and apparently Walter Bobby's rationale, the director, is that because they already have the musicians on stage, as you know, the orchestra, actual orchestra on stage, they thought it would be overkill, and also I guess logistically and maybe even financially they couldn't figure out how to work having a separate circle of musicians downstage. But whatever the reason, it is kind of unusual to see a cut like that in Encores. I thought the production was much better than some of the quite negative reviews that I read, but I can see why people were upset. John Turturro is an excellent actor, but he did not quite seem as charismatic as he should have been for this guy who convinces a complete stranger to take him on as his employee and eventually really become his best friend there in Greece. And on top of that, most of the singing was fine, but some of the extended high notes that John Turturro had were incredibly painful. And it's not – I just think that we should expect more from Encores. The same somewhat lesser degree, I should say, was true of Zoe Wanamaker as Hortense. She seemed more successful overall in her performance, but there again, some notes that just really didn't make it. And I, you know, having just seen The Visit and Roger Rees attempting unsuccessfully to sing that role, it's been a little scary lately because I'm not used to hearing people sing that poorly in, you know, major professional engagements like this. And I understand, you know, I mean, there have always been some people like that where the thought is that the presence and the acting ability outweighs the musical
limitations.
Thank you. But it's, you know, it's all a matter of degree and it's all a matter of opinion. And I think in some of these cases, they should have worked a little harder maybe to find other people who can actually sing the notes, because it can be very distracting. It takes you out of the show, I find. It's not so much that it doesn't sound good, but it makes you nervous for the performer because you don't know what's going to come out next. Although I did like this production, as I said, quite a bit more than many other people that I read, I think that it was not one of Encore's best efforts. Having said that, Maren Mazey sounded absolutely amazing. The friend whom I went with turned to me at one point and said she's ready for a Vita. Her voice, I think, if anything, has gotten better than it was. I mean, it was always phenomenal with a beautiful, rich soprano range and a really strong, firm belt. But now the whole thing just sounds richer and more beautiful. And I'm so glad I saw this only for her. She sings a lot in the production, including most of the opening number. And that she keeps coming back to comment and, I guess, comment more than narrate on the action. So she was quite great. Santino Fontana as Nico, was very good. Robert Cuccioli as Mavrodani in a non-singing role, but doing a really good job. And Adam Chandler Barat as Mimiko. And Zoe Wanamaker is really – I mean, she is a great actress, and I thought she – pulled it off for the most part, except for those few places. So I'm glad they picked Zorba. It's sort of a cult show in a way, because as I say, it's not done that often, but the score is quite superb and really so fascinating that Kander and Ebb's scores are so different from one another. I mean, some of them are somewhat similar in some ways, but I think one of our guests recently made the point that they uh, they were and are so versatile in that respect. And they, I think for whatever reason, they're not necessarily still thought of as when people name the greatest composers and lyricists on Broadway. I don't know if necessarily if they still come to mind within the top three or four or five, but they really should be, because that's how great they are. And I think time will only increase people's respect for them.
Great. So Encores is sticking to the mission and bringing us these type of shows that we wouldn't normally see. I'm assuming from your take on this is that we're not going to look for a transfer of this.
Well, I wouldn't think so. And unfortunately, some people have responded to this production by saying the show isn't very good. It certainly has its flaws. There is a character of a widow, and there's a whole very dramatic, very serious, very sad subplot involving this widow and her romance with Nico, played by Santino Fontana. And what happens to her is very, very hard to take. And also, I didn't quite understand why everyone in the show hated her so from the beginning. I don't know if some of the book material was cut out in the adaptation, or if that's just a flaw in the show itself. But the score is really great, and I urge everyone to at least try to get the original cast recording, which is the preferred one. The revival one is also good, but it has some of those changes. And as I said, Anthony Quinn cannot quite sing it. But Herschel Pernardi on the original is great. And we have Maria Karnilova as Hortense. And that's just one of those gems of a cast album that's not necessarily owned by as many people as own, you know, Cabaret or Fiddler on the Roof or The Sound of Music. So definitely, absolutely, really check that out if you can.
All right, so let's move on. Michael also got a chance to see the Fiasco Theater's production of Two Gentlemen of Verona at Theater for the New Audience, all the way in Brooklyn. Michael, you cross boroughs.
Yes, I do. Yeah, Peter's in London, and I was in Brooklyn. We get around.
All right, so what do you think of Two Gentlemen?
Well, this was my first time at the theater itself, which is called the Polonsky Shakespeare Center, literally across the street, like sort of catty corner to Brooklyn Academy of Music. And this was a Fiasco Theater production. They're a very creative troupe. They just recently did at the Roundabout, as some of you may have seen, that very minimalist, pared down, small cast production of Into the Woods. And I enjoyed that very much. I think I liked The Two Gentlemen of Verona even better. This is the play, by the way, not the musical, the play by Shakespeare. I think I liked it even better because it is their actual métier. That's what they usually do. More like classics, Shakespeare and the classics. And this, again, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 actors. Wow. 1 15-minute intermission. Show was 2 hours with the intermission. I guess they cut some, but it wasn't that obvious. And there was just so much energy in the production and the performances. And they had a great, really great set, simple but great set design. The play has a lot of letters in it, a lot of notes and letters that people write to each other. And they use that as the concept. And there were literally – it seemed like there must have been 10,000 letters, like handwritten notes on pieces of paper, all over the back wall, the sides, the proscenium. It was really great. So simple and yet so effective. And the cast: Jesse Austrian, Noah Brody, Paul L. Coffey, Zachary Fine, Andy Grotelution, and Emily Young. Really superb across the board. There were a couple of times when I was a little confused because of the role doubling, partly because Two Gentlemen is not really a play I know all that well. But for the most part, it was very clear, very, very clear storytelling. And this is a company one should definitely keep one's eye on, the Fiasco Theater. I'm not sure why they picked that name for themselves. I suppose it's ironic, but they're really a great company.
Well, and they just announced this week that their production of Into the Woods that you mentioned is going to go on a national tour. They haven't released the dates or the cities yet, but a lot of people outside of New York, like myself, might have a chance to see them that they might not otherwise have the opportunity to do.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's wonderful. You should catch up with them.
All right. So, Michael, you also got a chance to see the Red Bull Theater's production of Tis Pity She's a Whore at the Duke on 42nd Street. So why don't you tell us about that?
Well, first of all, what a title, huh?
Happy Mother's Day.
Oh, yeah, there's that.
I mean, doesn't it make you just like want to run and see it? I had never seen a production. It's quite famous play by John Ford, dating from, they're not even sure, I guess, exactly when it was written. It says circa 1630 to 1633. And what it basically is I think the little tagline they used for this production is, "What if Romeo and Juliet were brother and sister?" It's about an incestuous relationship between a brother and sister in Parma, not Verona, but elsewhere in Italy. I guess all these Parmesan people. And it is really – my reaction to this production was that I enjoyed it thoroughly. It was incredibly entertaining, but the tone for me kept shifting wildly from one scene to the next, one character to the next. And I'm not sure how much of that is inherent in the play itself. So I am going to have to read it, which it's amazing that I have not done so by now. Maybe I read it in college. It's considered a touchstone of drama at that time. So I may have read it, but there's a lot of stuff that I read that is not didn't like make it into the permanent memory banks, or if it did, has now left that place. Anyway, "'Tis Pity She's a Whore" by John Ford. This production at the Duke on 42nd Street, which every time I go into it, it seems like it's set up differently. It's a very malleable space in terms of the seating configuration and et cetera, et cetera. Directed by Jesse Berger, very nice, very, very nice unit set, two-level unit set. Among the cast members whom our listeners might be familiar with are Christopher Invar, Derek Smith, and Everett Quinton. And Rocco Sisto, and then several other names that work constantly in New York theater. The Red Bull is a wonderful company, and the audience certainly seemed to enjoy it, although James related an anecdote that maybe you might want to repeat.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, one of our colleagues, Michael.
I relate many anecdotes. So. So Michael Dale on Facebook, who you should totally follow on Facebook. Is he also on Twitter? Or so.
I think he is, but he does not post nearly as much as he does on Facebook.
But if you can find him on Facebook, do check it out. He was relating yesterday, the day before, he said that he was at this production that Michael's talking about of "'Tis Pity She's a Whore," and that during one of these scenes, which is very graphic, people left because it wasn't graphic sexually, it was graphic like scary, bloody type of graphic type of thing. I don't want to spoil it, so I won't tell you exactly, but
there's the character of believe it or not, her name is Putana, which basically has come to mean whore, you know. But
no translation needed.
but she's not the title of the play refers to, it's actually I think the last line in the play, and it refers to Annabella, who is the young lady who is in love with her brother. And Annabella is played by Amelia Pedlow, and Giovanni, the brother, is played by Matthew Amant. But Putana, played by Franchelle Stewart Dorn, is the tutoress to Annabella. And her name, I don't know why she has that name, but anyway, she winds up meeting a very, very graphic end. It's something that also happens in King Lear. Let me put it that way. That's very, very hard for an audience to watch, especially depending on how realistically at stage. And also, and not only in that scene, but there's an awful lot of damn blood in this play. And I don't know about you, have I mentioned this? I've seen a lot of shows and musicals recently with stage blood, and I hate that smell. Mm. I don't know if they still use Karo syrup. That used to be the basis back in the day. I don't know if they've come up with anything else, but I think it might still be that because it has this really sickly sweet smell to it. And actually, the smell bothers me more than the sight of the blood. So I hope I have a break from that for a while. What am I seeing? I'm seeing The Glass Menagerie next week. I don't suppose it's going to have stage blood in it.
No.
I'm seeing Merrily We Roll Along. You think I'm safe?
Unless John Doyle directs it. Hey, John Doyle, what other shows can you ruin?
I did want to say, James, I'm glad you brought that up in a way, because I was going off about how very, very poor I thought John Doyle's direction of The Visit is, and I stand by that. But I do want to say I was a great fan of his up until this. I really thought that his approaches worked very well for Company and Sweeney Todd and Passion down at CSC.
Allegro at CSC?
Yes, he did. Actually, that one I didn't like as much, but he's lots of shit, and
I'm hit and miss with him too. Some of the things, like I really like Passion at CSC, and I've liked a few of his other things, but
he also doesn't direct always in the same style. He did Where's Charlie for Encores, and that was wonderful. So I did just want to say that I overall really like his work. I just think he missed the mark on The Visit,
I reflected upon that after last week's discussion about The Visit, and I was really angry because I was like, it seems like Cheetah, it's probably the last time Cheetah's going to originate a role on stage, and it's the last of the great Candor and Ebb to come to Broadway, and it was just so much tied up in it that I really wanted it to be better, and it wasn't.
Yeah, I agree, and I actually have access to a video of the signature production, which I had seen live. And I have not had the time, but I really want to watch that. And because my memory is that I enjoy that so much more. Similar to Zorba, it is sad because, again, you have some people saying this show is not very good. Mm-hmm. When it's not the show so much, it can be the production, and it's even after 50 years of theater going or whatever I've been doing, I still am somehow amazed how much difference that can make. It seems like some shows are more indestructible than others, but then on the other hand, we saw the Roundabout production of Bye Bye Birdie, and we saw and we saw the last Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. So maybe that's not even true. But what I will say is generally true is that the more challenging shows, the darker ones, they really have to be done just perfectly and very well. Otherwise, they they're not going to work. So just an observation.
Well, and I think it's really important to note that all of this stuff is such a collaboration.
Oh, sure.
That people, it's hard to make a show actor proof or director proof or things like that. It's really, it has to do with everybody's talent and how they collaborate together. And I think that many people often forget that, and they write it off as saying, oh, that was a really bad show, Andrew Lloyd Webber or Stephen Sondheim or et al. Mm. Or Candor and Ebb, that wasn't their best work, when it, probably related to other factors that we don't take into account, but we can't verbalize that often.
But that's why so often we will listen to cast albums of shows that were flops and say, oh my God,
the Broadway production of Passion, the Broadway production of Passion, I went to go see it and I hated it. And I got the cast recording and I loved it. And I was like, what in the world? How did I, but it was just that I loved you know, the book and the show and the music and things like that. I guess it was the direction that didn't do it for me back in 94.
And similarly, that's why Frank Wildhorn still gets shows produced.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. All right. So let's move forward into our Matt Tamminiti sequence. So Matt's joining us again. Matt, I guess your last time with us was about 2 months ago after all the shows opened up. And we last left off with a bunch of television things that have happened.
Yeah.
So why don't you catch us up on what's happening on television as it relates to Broadway and Broadway performers?
Sure. The first fairly big news, we know that The Wiz is going to be NBC's next live production. Kenny Leon is directing, recent Tony winner, and Atlanta native Kenny Leon is directing. And just late Friday night, news was released that they've inked some creative folks to join the production. Fatima Robinson is going to be the choreographer, and Stephen Arimus is going to be the music director. Stephen Arimus, as you know, anyone who's been following Broadway over the last decade or so knows he's
very
been
talented,
the arranger and orchestrator and supervisor on Avenue Q and Wicked and Book of Mormon and Kinky Boots. So that's the music obviously is going to be definitely in good hands for The Wiz Live. And Fatima Robinson is probably more on the popular music side for people. She's choreographed music videos for Michael Jackson and Aaliyah and Mary J. Blige and then the Black Eyed Peas and stuff. But she also did some movies, movie choreographing as well, and Save the Last Dance. She choreographed the Dreamgirls film. So she's pretty adept at bringing dance to screen. So I think it looks like, you know, it's a different group than did Peter Pan and The Sound of Music, but it looks like it's a group that has the chops to make this work pretty well. So I'm excited to see what this crew puts together in December.
All they need is a new director.
I've never said, I lived in Atlanta, went to a lot of shows at Kenny Leon's True Colors Theater in Atlanta. But I was thinking when they announced this, I couldn't think of a single musical that I've seen that he directed.
Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me. Did you say he's directing this one?
Yes.
Oh, I was referring to Rob Ashford.
Oh, no. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. Oh, that's fantastic.
I mean, Kenny did direct Holler If You Hear Me.
Oh, well, yeah, I didn't see that. I didn't make it up for that week that it ran on Broadway.
Actually, June 19th to July 20th. So, but
I apologize. I somehow missed that name. I heard you talking about the choreographer and Stephen Arimus, but I think that's a very, very good sign.
Yeah. Kenny's great, and obviously the with the Tony win this past year for Raisin in the Sun, he's, you know, kind of becoming a little bit more of a well-known figure to those outside of the Broadway community. So I think this is going to be great. It seems to be a perfect 10 on every decision they've made so far with this production.
And including the choice of the property, because as I believe I've said before, if there's anything that needs a remake,
it's that. And they had said that they were going back and forth between doing this and The Music Man. And if there's anything that doesn't need a remake, it's probably The Music Man. Although the one that Neil and Craig did in the 90s with Matthew Broderick and Kristen Chenoweth, as much as I enjoy them, that was awful. So I don't know that we want that to be the last thing. But when the original movie was so good, we can wait another year or so to get back to The Music Man, I think.
Oh, and I think it's okay if the first one is the best one. I mean,
absolutely,
it's still available. It looks great,
and it's on TV all the time. So you can check your cable listings and probably find it sometime this week.
Now, speaking of TV and Broadway, I should mention while we were speaking with Betty Buckley that I saw Carol Burnett last night at the St. George Theater on Staten Island, which is where some of Smash was filmed.
Yeah,
I believe they used only the stage itself. But now I think maybe partly from the money they got from Smash, they have done a major renovation of
really?
the of the theater. It's still not complete, but the entire orchestra section had been cannibalized years ago. Some idiots tried to make it into a mall. and they took people are really smart, you know, sometimes, you know. They had taken out almost all the orchestra seats and put it in this huge concrete block in the middle of the orchestra to make it level. And then the mall lasted like a month, I think, and then the theater was empty for years. And then they tried to do shows there again, but then they couldn't do them on the stage because of the setup, so they would do them on the concrete block. And it just was a mess. But anyway, now they've got gorgeous new seats throughout the theater, and it was just amazing to be there. And if Smash helped that to happen, then I think that is a really fantastic thing. And to see Carol Burnett there, with all of her clips of all of her amazing guests that she had on her variety show, many, many of whom came from Broadway, and all of them singing fantastic Broadway and American songbook standard songs. It was quite an evening last night.
Very cool.
Wow. So, Matt, what else is happening in the television world?
Well, this is something that was announced a week or so ago and is very important for Broadway folks. I think on the same day that they announced the Tony nominations, they announced the Tony hosts, which was quite a little bit of a surprise, I think, when they announced that Kristen Chenoweth and Alan Cumming were going to be hosting. It really took people by surprise. The general consensus was that it was going to be one of CBS's new late-night talk show hosts, Tony winner James Corden or Stephen Colbert, who from his previous show on Comedy Central had shown a love for musical theater, and he did the concert production of Company. So everyone kind of just assumed that it was going to be one of them, or even Jim Parsons, who is obviously in previews now in An Act to God on Broadway, but is also a CBS employee with Big Bang Theory. It was just kind of assumed that CBS would have one of their own hosting. Now, Kristen and Alan both have connections to The Good Wife on CBS, but it was still kind of out of left field. So I was surprised by this, but I'm interested to see how Kristen and Alan work together. I've seen in her foray into country music, Kristen has hosted some country music award shows that were, let's just say, grading at best. So, she's a lovely person and just charming as all get out when you see her. But those award shows didn't work all that well. And I have been a huge Kristen fan for, decades now. And those were a little off-putting. So I'm excited to see how, in kind of her natural habitat of musical theater, how she pulls this off. So I'm excited. I was a little surprised. But I'm interested to see how this turns out.
Well, as we know, a lot of it is about the writing. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
We'll see. But I am not a huge fan of Alan Cumming, but I kind of think that he and Kristen might have a really wonderful, delightful chemistry.
Yes.
So we'll see.
Yeah. And actually it came out this past week that, CBS did approach Jim Parsons about hosting, and he just said, I can't do it. I would be too nervous. It's interesting. It's interesting for a guy who, obviously is a television star, but, visits, the Broadway stage quite often, that they would be so nervous to take that on. And he talked about in a recent appearance, just talking about the first preview in An Act of God, how he was sick to his stomach and he was so nervous. As good as the material is, a lot of these people still, have to conquer that stage fright to get up there. So it was kind of an interesting way to see behind the curtain for a performer who is beloved yet still has a little hesitation about putting himself out there. So that was pretty fun to see.
Well, and can you imagine that magnified not only by the fact that the theater seats about four times the amount of people, and plus the however many, I'm sure it's still in the millions, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow. I think I'd be a little nervous.
Absolutely. Yeah. And not to say that Jim Parsons is his character from Big Bang Theory, but there seems to be a little idiosyncrasies that he shares with Sheldon on the Big Bang Theory. So it didn't really surprise me when he said he would get a little overwhelmed.
All right. So Tell us about some of the tours that have come through Orlando.
I think since we've spoken recently, the shows that have come through, have seen we've had Motown and Pippin, two very different shows, but both very entertaining. I think, James, you and I had talked about some of the changes that were being made for the Motown tour. And so I kind of went back and forth between the playbill we got here in Orlando and then the opening night cast. And one of the major changes is that the cast for the tour is down 9 actors. It went from 36 on opening night on Broadway to 27 for the tour, and maybe it was just because maybe I had pretty good seats and could see people a little more clearly, but it was pretty obvious that those ensemble members were running around like chickens with their heads cut off to fill in all those parts. And it was not necessarily, you know, a detriment to the show, but if you were paying attention to that, it could be distracting. And so I know that the producers want to save some money and bring the show back to Broadway. And it definitely looks like cutting back on the 9 or so actors and 3 musicians. There were actually 3 fewer musicians in the pit than on Broadway. That's one of the places they did it. It was still, you know, an incredibly enjoyable show, mostly on the strength of the music and the performers. The book itself, as I'm sure both of you have seen, there's not a whole lot there. But it was still enjoyable to see a really fantastic cast singing just, you know, quintessential American music on stage, and great dancing and all that. So a good show for nostalgia, not necessarily a revolutionary Broadway story, but an enjoyable show nonetheless.
Well, if I recall, I'm pretty sure when they announced that the show would be closing on Broadway, they announced the tour and the return to
Correct.
Broadway, and also the downsizing. They were
Yes.
very upfront about it. And my reaction then is the same. I can't believe, because as it was, I couldn't believe how much doubling there was
Yep.
in the show. Doubling, that's not the word. Quadrupling,
yeah.
whatever. More than that, because they really do. To me, the big flaw of the show was that they tried to fit in too much. And I understand why. They don't want to leave out anyone's favorite song or songs, such great songs, but that resulted in 2 things: people running around, like you said, with like chickens with their heads cut off, trying to change wigs and costumes, you know, to go from being one part of one group to another.
Mm-hmm.
But then also they hardly sang any song complete. They would sing like
exactly.
the first A section, and then go to the bridge, and then the last section. And that may sound minor, but it just became annoying to me after a while.
Well, yeah, there's 60 different songs listed in the playbill, and I believe when I wrote a review for it, there's over 90 characters listed.
Yeah.
So when you've got 27 actors portraying 90 different people, and then you figure, you know, there's a handful, 4 or 5 people who are only portraying one character, that gets a little messy. It gets a little convoluted. So that's right. definitely a part of that. And if that's the structure that they maintain when and if they come back to Broadway, I'm sure people will note that. But when it comes down to it, you're going to see Motown for the music anyway.
Right.
So, you know, it is what it is, and they know how to make money off of it. And if it gives 27 actors and 15 musicians and however many stagehands an opportunity to be employed, you know, all the better for them, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then Pippin, Pippin is one of those shows that I grew up listening to the cast album and absolutely adored. But other than seeing the 1981 filmed version, I'd never actually seen a stage production of Pippin. So when it came through town, I was very excited. We got 2 new cast members. I think Sam Lipps and Adrian Barbeau joined the cast, the tour stopped before it came to Orlando. And I absolutely adored the show. Sam Lipps as Pippin, who I believe was an understudy on Broadway. He was a little – he seemed a little worn. I think maybe coming into the role on the road had worn him down a little bit. But he was very charismatic, very enjoyable. I thought he was a little too – maybe even a little too studly to play Pippin. But, you know, he was very good. But Adrienne Barbeau is a legend, and she was – still maybe a little hesitant on the tricks, but so much charisma, so much personality, so much stage presence playing Bertha. It was it was easily the best show that's come through Orlando this season and in the new Dr. Phillips Center. But I was really kind of blown away by the ending, blown away by the theatricality of the message finally being unveiled. I was quite taken by this one. This is one that I've mulled over in my head numerous times in the past few weeks. So if you enjoyed the cast recording of the original cast, this is one that will definitely give you some new insight into the show.
All right. So I wanted to ask, we talked a little bit about the Tony Awards before. I asked the two of you, I saw on social media that there is outrage that Tommy Toon's Lifetime Achievement is not going to be broadcast on the Tony Awards, but I can't find a source for that. Have you guys heard it? Have you seen a source for that?
Is that something that they really decide definitively this far in advance?
I don't know. I've been looking around for a source. I haven't seen, you know, New York Times, Variety, the typical, you know, that what's that website, Broadway World or something?
I looked there. It sounds familiar.
I didn't see anything, but, you know, I think Broadway World puts out in an hour more than a Sunday New York Times does in as far as text goes. So it's hard to find things at times.
Tell me about it. It seems to me that it might have even been something. I don't know if it was Tommy Toons or one of the other Lifetime Achievement people that was going to be presented, wasn't even going to be presented that night. It was going to be something presented at a ceremony ahead of time. Am I completely making that up?
That's what I was looking for. I'm not sure. It could be true.
They have had for quite a few years now a separate category called Tony Honors.
I'm going to have to
reread those press releases also. I'm not sure if any of these were in that category, but I know Tony Honors go to things that are not normally eligible because they're not Broadway or whatever. For example, Gerard Alessandrini and Forbidden Broadway won some years ago. That's the only other separate actual ceremony that I know of. So I don't know if any of these. And who were the other people who were announced?
The other honorees.
The ones that have already been announced in addition to Tommy Toon.
Let's see. It was Arnold Abramson, Adrian Brian Brown, and Gene O'Donovan.
Oh yes, Adrian. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I'm not sure which, but I think that's what you're referring to, Matt. We'll have to check that out.
Yeah, we'll loop back if we hear any more of that. Before we wrap up, there's just been a ton. Is this my imagination, or is it a lot more this year of announced national tours? It seems like everybody's heading to see Tamanini.
That's great, because the more Broadway level shows we can get in Orlando, the better it is.
Well, I do just wish, I mean, because, you know, one never knows, and each case is probably different, but it looks so much like a ploy for Tony Awards from the road voters when they announce them right.
That's true.
Right at this point, you know, like right before nominations or right after nominations. So, you know, whatever.
Well,
The King and I, On the Town, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, American in Paris. I think, did Zhivago announce a national tour? And Finding Neverland, Something Rotten.
Neverland did. I'm not sure about Zhivago.
Yeah, I didn't.
Zhivago, I don't know about that. But it seems to me like a lot more announcements right now. And that's a very good point that Michael brings up. It could be a ploy for national tour voters, Tony voters who host national tours.
Doesn't mean that they're not going to really do them. But what I'm saying is, and presumably they wouldn't, announce one just
the timing is important. Yeah. Well, and also it was interesting to me that over the course of 2 days, we heard that not only is Tony Yazbek going to lead the On the Town tour, but then Idina Menzel is going to join the If Then tour.
That's the next thing I was going to bring up is that Idina is supposed to be on a world concert tour, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. And if you looked closely at that press release, she's only going to be doing select cities. And they're all Denver West and a lot of California. So it might be that she just has some overlap in her concert tour. But it was interesting to me that you know, you had both a Tony-nominated star in Tony Azbeck for On the Town, and then a Tony-nominated star, obviously a winner for Wicked, but in Idina coming to If Then, if they were announced. That's something that we haven't really seen, and you guys would probably know more than I would, but we haven't really seen, you know, Broadway stars going on the road with their shows in a long time.
Yeah, but I may be wrong. I cannot imagine anyone buying tickets for that show when she's not in it.
If Then, yeah.
Yeah, do you agree?
Well, I think there's a section of fans that I've seen online from across the country that were really moved by the story of a conflicted woman being told in a musical that I think will be very interested to see the show on tour. But there is no doubt that both on Broadway and still on tour, the draw is Idina Menzel. I mean, she's gone from a big Broadway star to a huge international star. And there's no doubt that her involvement in the show will skyrocket the box office for those cities.
And we'll see how it does in the other cities.
Yeah.
But I think also parenthetically, I believe that they said that Tony Yazbek is not doing all cities either.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I think so. I think that it said that. Yeah.
All right. I did have one more thing that I wanted to mention, and it has eluded me. So maybe we'll throw it in next week. So I want to wrap up and remind listeners that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And listen to us streaming there. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Saturdays at One more time. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Michael, Matt, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com as well. As I mentioned before, Peter will be back next week. Oh, that's what I wanted to mention. For all of you who tuned out, you won't get to hear this part. So have you guys seen this? Let me find this kid's name.
Are you talking about Ian?
No, not Ian.
Oh, okay.
Michael, did you go to the Easter Bonnet?
Oh, right, yeah.
Not this year. I missed it.
I got, you know, I was wondering, we didn't get an Easter Bonnet pictorial setup, but so there's a 13-year-old Joshua Colley. Matt, do you know?
I don't know, but I don't know the pronunciation, but
so Joshua is in the cast of Les Miserables, and I guess he is Gavroche or something in the cast, and he did the confrontation scene where he played the Valjean. And the video is on the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and he is amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. Check it out. I'm going to touch base with the Les Mis folks and see if we can get him on to talk with us, because he's just an amazing talent. He's 13, and I hope that we see a lot of him in the future.
They've done, as I say, I missed this Easter Bonnet, unfortunately, but for the past several years, there have been so many shows on Broadway with kids, and some of the highlights of several of the Broadway Cares shows, the Easter Bonnet and the Gypsy of the Year, have been featuring kids doing things like that. There was one year that kids did like wildly inappropriate shows, like they were doing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And they're so talented, and the audience just screams in laughter. I mean, this sounds like something different. It wasn't a parody so much, but yes, it's great that they get them involved in those in these events and give them these incredible showcases.
Yeah, so if you want to see that, I will. You go to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. It'll be there for another day or so on the front page of Broadway Stars. It'll also be on the show notes for BroadwayRadio.com. So on behalf of Matt Tamanini and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Hi.
Hi.
You came to stay and live. live my way, scatter my love like leaves in the wind. You always say you won't go away, but I know what it always has been. What it always has been. Small things like reasons are put in a jar. Whatever happened to wishes wished on a star? Was it just something that I made up for fun?